Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 16th of October, 2019, 2 days away from my 48th birthday. 48, I'm pretty sure, is the most boring of the birthdays. There's no 48 card at Hallmark. If any of you feel in the mood to buy me a new car, I wouldn't be opposed to it. You don't have to wrap it or anything. Just, you know, deliver it somewhere. Speaking of which, I, always start off these things by thanking my donors. You know, you guys, make it possible for me to function. And, I truly appreciate it. And, you know, I couldn't do this without you. This is, as I've said 100 times, this is a full-time job. There's no way to do this part-time. I'm going to prove it here in a minute. But it's a big deal for me that I have people who are willing to do that for me. Up until, you know, a year ago, I had no idea. I've been through the mill, as you know. And suddenly, and I give everything away for free. But, you know, I have to eat once in a while. So, I want to talk about something that is somewhat of a slight departure. We talked about the Crimean War recently. We've talked about a lot of 19th century phenomenon that created this postmodern disaster that we live in today. It's Orwellian in every sense. I want to talk about something that's not all that dissimilar, and that is the Opium Wars in China from 1839 to 1860. This war, and a lot of our people have spoken about it before, this is one of the more obnoxious forms of imperialism, and it's one of just a blatant, there's really no defense of it, because it was based entirely on profits derived from getting the Chinese hooked on narcotics, which of course has some vague connection to the invasion in of Afghanistan, and now of course the U.S. is being defeated, has been defeated, and has been driven out, signing surrender documents. They're not called that, of course, with the Taliban, and that's what happens when an experienced, dedicated, highly religious group of men take on people like Americans. It's a shame that Americans have to die for this, but even more of a shame was that British kids were being killed for drug money. And the British government, through its East India Company, and then after that, the Sassoon, the Jewish banking clan, used the British infantry as a personal bodyguard. We have a similar situation in Hawaii. Maybe one day I'll do something. Hawaii is, again, very similar to this. Deanna Spingola, my friend, who I respect very much, has a great piece on this. They actually were Jacobins. You know, they called themselves a Committee of Public Safety and tricked the U.S. Grover Cleveland, the only president who had an invasion of another country and he didn't even know. That's what happens when an oligarchy, in this case, the big fruit companies and sugarcane companies, run things. You know, the Navy was involved in a conflict, and Grover Cleveland, he was informed later. But opium is even worse, at least because, you know, they were killing people. And you'll see both the so-called war on drugs, which, of course, it can't be called a war. The only thing they did was increase prison terms for people. Otherwise, it has no relationship to a war. You know, in a war, enemy soldiers don't get lawyers. You know, they get killed. Every police department and every major city in America knows where every crack den is, knows who all the dealers are. They could be rounded up in about 3 hours. But the situation was identical in the middle of the 19th century as it is now, as far as the importance of drug money to the economy. And, you know, wherever there's this massive income, the regime is going to want a piece of it. Now, there were two opium wars, two separate conflicts, one more obnoxious than the next. It changed the world because it knocked China out of contention as a hegemon. China was the world's largest economy at the time. Or at least up until, you know, the beginning of the 19th century. Now, the only way that you do have people actually defending the opium war today, but the way that they do it is pretend it's not about opium. They'll say that, well, that the issue was free trade and to kill, you know, thousands of people to make sure that free trade is enforced. You know, free trade enforced doesn't make any sense, but that's okay. That's really what this was about. Opium, it was unfortunate. That was the cause, but you know, that's not really the fundamental, the final cause. So the conclusion of these were, unfortunately, you know, the Qing dynasty in China was humiliated and defeated. You know, it was a dynasty that was militaristic, that based its legitimacy, among other things, on its military prowess. And when it was so badly beaten, very quickly, even though they outnumbered, you know, the British 10-1 in most cases, it had very little legitimacy. And of course, Sun Yat-sen and the revolution occurred just a generation later. You know, China was Asia's dominant power by far up until this period. In terms of GNP, they were the largest economy in the world. Now, the foundation, the reason I'm doing this, not only because this is a harbinger of what the 20th century is going to be, but there is this really, you know, libertarians, conservatives, you know, I was a kind of a paleo conservative years ago, and in college, never after that, in college I bought into the myth that the free market is just this kind of natural state of human beings, that it was a development from the decay of feudal relations, and it's far freer than other forms of previous forms of economy. In fact, even synonymous with freedom itself, as you'll see here. But it's strange that the capitalist economy, the free market, whether it be domestic or international, is always imposed by force. There has never been a moment, not a split second, in economic history where the state has not been essentially involved in building this so-called free economy. The common claim that, you know, libertarians and conservatives will make is that, well, the state is just a parasite. It takes from productive labor without being productive itself. But the fact of the matter is that the global trade regime, domestically and internationally, was the creation of the state with a handful of oligarchic families that benefit from it. So around the time of the American Revolution, the British East India Company began making huge amounts of money pushing narcotics, that is to say opium, grown in India, onto the gigantic Chinese market. Opium was illegal in both China and Britain. So the big banking families, the Sassoons in particular, were drug pushers. You know, it was illegal in Britain. They forced it on China. So they knew it was a bad thing. They knew it was killing people. So they became the first drug cartel by 1800. And they were involved in all kinds of cunning ways to smuggle drugs into the country. Opium was measured in chests, each one weighing just a little under, about 180 pounds on average. So by 1830, the average yearly amount was something like 4,000 chests. And at the time, it made up of almost 20, maybe over 20% of the East India Company's income. And of course, there you work for them in this field. You were very well paid. EIC agents in the opium trade were getting about 9,000 pounds a year, which is more than even cabinet-level politicians were getting. in Sindh, on the Pakistan-India border on the Arabian Sea, was absorbed into the British Empire entirely because they wanted to isolate this poppy-growing area. It was annexed in 1843. And then to dominate this area, to make sure nothing was to happen, they took advantage of the Hindu-Muslim split there. And that made sure that their rule was absolute. And they poured cash into the irrigation systems and everything else. It was a Garden of Eden for drug addicts. But to use the rival, and it's not an accident that this is the place they chose, because they were able to use one group against another to make sure that they were absolutely, that their rule was, you know, they could simply divide their opposition with no problem. So it became the mainstay of the elite economy in India and even major British companies. We've said this, you know, after the 2008 crash in the U.S., I mean, I have the SEC saying this, drug money was the only thing keeping the stock market going. This is why, you know, it's not being shut down. This is your predecessor here. People who were defending this trade would say that, and remember, the British never quite, maybe at the end of the Second Opium War, up until that point, they never quite admitted that they were doing this. But they would say it indirectly, and they would say that, well, if we avoid selling that product, it will strangle the Indian economy, it will strangle the EIC. And it's, you know, how modern the British were. You talk about the British, you know, defending the British elites, of course, defending the opium trade. It sounds like, you know, some hippie on a college campus. They make the same thing. China needs to get with the times. They need to open up their markets to our goods. Of course, they mean drugs, but they use the abstract goods. This is the Manchu dynasty, or the Qing dynasty, debated the legalization of opium, which was heavily funded by the British, no doubt, but it failed. The emperor passed many laws banning the opium trade. The first one was 1729, then there was another one 1799, 1814, 1831, and then that was re-emphasized in 1834. But of course, it didn't matter because there was so much money to be made, whether it be, you know, China or Afghanistan or Latin America, no one could resist it. So, you know, I mentioned that, you know, I guess... you know, you had a gigantic trade developing in terms of the chest amounts. You know, 4,000 chests by 1830. By the middle of that decade, this is how fast it was developed. By the middle of that decade, it was 30,000 sent into China. And it was the port of Canton, or Guangdong today. That was a so-called free trade zone. Most of China was closed, but that was a free trade city. And enforcement could be more lax there. But given the huge amount of money and the number of addicts was so high, it was easy to get through. At the time, so the middle of the 1830s, there were about 15 million Chinese addicts. And then eventually, you know, the EIC loses its monopoly status in 1834, but it doesn't matter because the trade already had its channels and had its people. And the fact that they lost their monopoly status just meant that the Sassoon found, I think, one of the reasons that they lost their monopoly status is that, you know, the big banking families wanted to individually go in and take advantage of them. Now, it's true that you do have somewhat of a minor tradition of opium consumption in China prior to the 19th century, but its use was confined only to the elite. And it was only, and then you had a few, maybe the middle class is trying to, you know, emulate their betters. But this was never a crisis. It was never really a problem. It was an elite pastime, and they could afford to do it. Only with the East India Company monopoly do you have the. And remember what they were doing. They weren't selling it. They were advertising it. They were saying that this cures various diseases. You know, they were saying that it, you know, pot smokers are doing that today. You know, they're trying to justify their addiction by saying it could cure any damn thing. You know, I mean, I think there's some evidence for the eyes, but for many other things, you know, it's, but they're claiming it cures cancer, that it cures, brings back people from the dead, that it, you know, anything to justify what they're doing. And I'd rather someone smoke grass than drink, especially what alcohol does to people. But I'd rather do neither. Although, you know, increasingly intoxicants seem to be more and more required living in the society. Now, of course, the separate question is why there were between 15 and 20 million addicts in China, but that's not for this discussion. I really don't know. But China declared a war on drugs. Again, you had a lot of rich Chinese merchants that were involved in this trade. Of course, they needed to have people on the ground. They couldn't just dump it. You know, they needed Chinese people to push it through. But the emperor, being essentially a military clan, had more power than they did. That was the only reason that he was able to say, no, we're not going to do it. And he sent a man in, legendary today, of course, because of what he did, Lin Zexu was sent in to stop the trade and crush opium use. And there was just the one port of entry. And this began in 18. So their drug war starts in 1834, and they did very, very well because they actually wanted to destroy it. It really cut in deeply into the company's profits, and it sent London into a panic. Lin was a totally incorruptible, and tough guy. This is why he was assigned to this, because knowing how much money these guys were making selling drugs, you couldn't have a guy that was willing to take bribes. So many of these officials did. And that was a closed official society. And Lin just had a reputation that he couldn't do it if he wanted to. He just was that kind of a man. So their patients had been, the British were lying. They were saying, we're not really involved in this. And yet it was flooding the country. The emperor ordered all opium seized and the ship's crews imprisoned, until they assured the authorities that all opium had been handed over. Now, when these drug pushers, when these big, the dealers and bankers would get into trouble, they would run home. Again, Johnson's Law is gigantic here. We'll talk about that in a minute because, China was very few people knew anything about China at the time in the West. They would say that British goods are being burned. British goods are being, our people are being thrown in jail for no reason. There are human rights abuses, all these stories about human rights abuses. Selling opium was punishable by death, and that includes foreigners. And finally, the port, the Guangdong port, was blockaded. And they, of course, wanted assurances from the British government that there's not going to be any of this Indian opium coming in anymore. Any drug dealer would be executed. All of a sudden, in the British press, you have stories of barbaric Chinese human rights abuses. The emperor was an anachronism. He has to go. But the British made it very clear. The Sassoon Banking Clan, yes, all these groups were saying the free market is sacred. And if they want it, they should have it. That's what we're here for. So Lin wrote to Queen Victoria. And he asked her. He said, where is your conscience? I've heard that smoking opium is forbidden in your country. Well, since it's not permitted to do harm in your own country, then even less should you let it be passed on to the harm of other countries. How much less to China? He said, as months accumulate and years pass by, the poison they have produced increases its wicked intensity. Repugnant odor reaches as high as heaven. Furious with urine, the gods moaning in pain, it's your best that you destroy and plow under all these opium plants and grow food instead, while issuing an order to punish severely anyone who dares to plant opium poppies again. A murderer of one person is subject to the death sentence. Just imagine how many people opium has killed. This is the rationale behind the new law, which says that any foreigner who brings opium to China will be sentenced to death by hanging or beheading. Our purpose is to eliminate this poison once and for all, for the benefit of all mankind. Now, Lin wrote this letter. He wrote more than one. None of them ever reached the Queen. First of all, they claimed that back in 1839, he wrote a letter to Queen Victoria. And they said, well, he's a barbarian. No matter how cultured, the Chinese are a high IQ. They're an elite people. No question about it. They're civilization creators. But they were barbarians as far as the bankers were concerned. And he had no right to address the queen directly. That was the first excuse. But then also, you know, Henry John Palmerston, who's a central figure here, who head of the Foreign Office and eventually prime minister, and really was, you know, dominant in foreign policy from roughly 1830-1851. And when he received another letter from Lynn, he refused to pass it on. It was seen by nobody. Now, eventually, the London Times did print it as kind of an appeal to the British people, but by then it was too late. And foreign merchants, it's the very same thing. They say, well, you know, it's their free choice if they want to buy. It's not our problem. You know, say the stupid argument, you know, about, you know, like pornography. Well, if you don't like it, don't watch it. Can you imagine being so stupid as making an argument like that and thinking that, you know, you said something intelligent? But it comes down to the fact that once money is being made, fortunes are being made, the human psyche, fallen though it is, will come up with any ridiculous syllogism to soothe their conscience. Because the willing people of China were willing to receive it, it's okay, so the EIC wrote. And even, you know, the EIC, right in Parliament itself, argued that because it's legal, because the British government accepts it, it must be good. They made that claim over and over and over again. It's eagerly sought by the Chinese people. They love it. And the merchants are of the highest caliber. These are wealthy men, elites, pillars of our society. Therefore, how bad could it be? Now, there were those who rejected it. There were people who couldn't. William Gladstone was a leader of the opposition in this respect. And, you know, but when the blockade came down, when Lin carried out the emperor's order and the war on drugs began, the press always tightly controlled. You know, liberalism has a controlled press, like it or not. And the Canton Press, which was the local British-owned press there, said this blockade is dangerous, unprecedented, unexplained circumstance. We're under imminent hazard of life and property, total disregard of honor and dignity. And they gave these harrowing tales about threatening language of the High Commissioner, and that he was the most dark and violent character. All these news stories started developing. And then Parliament, of course, the issue comes up to and including war. And as always, the press controlled debate. The press decided what two sides, what there were only two sides and what those arguments were, what were reasonable arguments and what were silly arguments. They decide this. They decide what arguments are acceptable and which aren't. So those opposed to the trade deal, the trade of opium, refused to talk about opium at all, as I mentioned. Primarily, the debate went like this. Those who were against the trade wouldn't talk. They really couldn't say, they couldn't admit in Parliament that opium was being sold. So it was really a ridiculous debate to begin with. But it was more that the current government let it go this far, and that Britain is humiliated and this government should fall. On the other hand, those following Palmerston and others said that your patriotism is a problem. And our free trade, without free trade, there is no Britain. And this is actually what's Queen Victoria's opinion. So simple logic really couldn't be followed. I mean, even Gladstone, who said that any opium trading was wrong and illegal, and China therefore had the right to enforce its own laws and get rid of these people. But he never said that. He never said that. He couldn't say that. If he said that, he'd be ripped apart in the press. And so David Sassoon, who was the Jewish oligarch who was the main financier of the opium trade, demanded British retaliation. And even Victoria was getting these stories from him and his agents that, you know, they were all these barbaric Chinese practices all of a sudden. Now, Both opium wars led to utter and rapid defeats. And I was never quite sure why that was the case. I mean, you have a huge civilization, advanced, highly literate, strong medical, scientific establishment, and yet they fell to pieces. I mean, with very little effort. The first opium war, I think Britain lost 69 guys. Now, China maintained an army of about 800,000 regulars, but that's on paper. Only half of them had firearms. You see, an imperial empire, like, you know, an empire like Britain, their militaries are nothing but combat experience. That's all they do. They're taking over countries, they're putting down rebellions, that's all they do. So anywhere the British went, you had strong, disciplined, battle-hardened men. Well, the Chinese, the army was pretty much used for local police duties. As it turns out, the emperor could mobilize barely 100,000. And because they were coming from all over China, and the muster was both ethnic and territorial, it took a long time. Not to mention the fact that everyone was addicted to opium, so, you know, it takes far longer than it normally would. And yet the British 5,000 Royal Army and 7,000 Royal Marines, highly experienced, very mobile, fast-moving, and they were able to mop the floor. And not to mention the fact that in terms of negotiations and tactics, a colonial empire, Britain or the Netherlands, they're used to using manipulation and Machiavellian tactics. They do that every day of their lives. China could never match them. They weren't an imperialist power. Commanders, because it really was, you know, the warfare was local. Commanders were never promoted on merit. It mostly had to do with noble status or education. So not only did the Chinese, were they poorly equipped and poorly trained with no experience, but you had very poor commanders. And, there were so many, it was hopelessly incompetent. And the British hired Chinese mercenaries. Again, opium sales are very lucrative. They were able to pay these guys a lot of money. And really the only chance that China ever had of winning was to draw the British into the interior and, you know, use their size and use the topography against them. Because it happened. They were able to do this in a few places. The British did very poorly then. But even the Chinese commanders weren't able to notice that. So the first war ended in 1842 with the Treaty of Nanking. And really the only purpose of the treaty was to permit and justify pumping the entire country full of drugs. Finally, they're talking about opium, openly. Not necessarily that the British or the government's doing it, because the EIC lost their, you know, they lost their monopoly, East India Company. But that private actors should be able to do it with full freedom, at least in the international cities. They were to be compensated for any opium that was destroyed by the Chinese government, and they asked for £2 million, and they asked for the takeover of several offshore islands, including Hong Kong. All told, the Chinese had to pay the banking families £22 million for the cost of the war, which sounds familiar because, you know, two generations later, you have World War I in Versailles. They demanded $6 million up front and then installments thereafter. So London gets Hong Kong and then five cities, rather than one, five cities were now treaty ports, Ningpo, Fuchao, Moy, Shanghai, and these now were free trade zones. So, again, remember, when I say Britain, I'm not referring to the British. It's a figure of speech. I'm really referring to those, to the oligarchy in general, the East India Company up to a certain point, and the banking families more specifically. David Sassoon starts his life, he was making rugs in Central Asia using sweatshop labor. And he sent his son, Elias, once the first war was over, to scope out the money that could be made here. And of course took advantage of the open up a branch of his operation in Hong Kong. Sassoon married a Rothschild, Carolyn, and was sent to Parliament because of the wealth. All this based on drugs. He was knighted by the Queen for being a drug. I mean, he had no other. He didn't do anything else. He was a drug dealer, and he was knighted, making a mockery of that tradition. The E.D. Sassoon Company was a shipping agent from India to Shanghai, and one of the reasons that the emperor could not bend in terms of enforcement was that China was being, not only were they dying, not only were they, you know, tens of millions of addicts, but money is being sucked out of that country in huge amounts. And then, of course, eventually the American Civil War breaks out. The Sassoons control cotton production. Since they're not buying Southern cotton anymore from the U.S., they're going to him. So this man, now married into the Rothschild family, is now one of the richest men in the world. And Rothschild and Sassoon go together. And this is from the Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1905 edition, that he had 8 sons, and according to them, he had the major opium. It was such a big business, they had opium exchanges in China. And in the 1944 edition of the Jewish Encyclopedia, it says that he only employed Jews in his business. And wherever he went, he built a synagogue and a school. He imported whole families of fellow Jews, they say. So he did this as a Jewish nationalist, not just as a businessman, but because he turned over a chunk of what he earned to the government, he could do as he pleased. So in essence, the Treaty of Nanking gave Sassoon pure monopoly rights to distribute opium in port cities. So Sassoon begins saying, this is oppressive. It's anti-Semitic. Because I'm not allowed to sell opium throughout the country. I want this to be nationwide. And that was the general cause of the second Opium War. And Palmerston pompously declared that all of the interior of China must be open for uninterrupted opium traffic in the name of sacred free trade. And this is what British kids are being killed for. And now the French want a piece of the action. The Second Opium War is 1856, 1860. And, you know, the banking families there, they're all related, of course. They don't want to be left out of this. The Treaty of Nanking was designed to be rejected. And the British also said the treaty is meaningless because we can change it whenever we want. So they had this new set of demands, the British did, knowing that the Manchus can't resist them. National opium trade, exempting foreign imports from all internal duties. And importantly, permission for the British ambassador to reside in Peking, which implies equality, which was a humiliating aspect of this. And they use this humiliation quite a bit. Now, there was an incident in October of 1856. Now, they're looking for, they need a second war to impose this on the Chinese. There are a couple of incidents that were more or less invented. Chinese Marines in Canton seized a cargo ship called the Arrow, the Lorcha Arrow, on suspicion of piracy. And they arrested, the crew was Chinese, and they arrested 12 of the 14 of them. Now, the Arrow, that ship, had been used by pirates before. It was captured and then resold. And as it turns out, those who they arrested were former pirates. So they had very good reason, and they had some evidence. This is what it was. Now, what was the way that they did it is that even Chinese ships were flying the British flag and were registered as British property because the treaty permitted total free trade and anything. But their registration had just lapsed just a few days earlier. So it was registered as a British ship, and the law said that a British captain has to be on every one, but that was only followed once in a while. Thomas Kennedy, was an Irishman who claimed to be aboard a nearby vessel, said he saw the Chinese Marines pulling down the British flag. He probably didn't see that. And then the press began inventing from there. Oh, he was beaten up. And the Marines were, you know, doing it for no reason. There were British people who were arrested. And what they're looking for is an excuse for another war. The press being controlled, tightly controlled back then, is essential. And we have the same situation now. Liberalism requires a centralized and tightly controlled press because liberalism is the expression of the political expression of oligarchy. And so the British press is goading the population into supporting war. The British began burning Chinese ships at Canton and Guangdong. And so the Chinese retaliated, setting fire to some British factories. So, you know, they demanded an apology. The crew members of the Arrow were released, but they didn't get one. Yi Mingchen was the viceroy, the emperor. And there was already plans to attack the city. So it didn't matter whether he apologized or not. They were going to invade it. Now there was an Indian rebellion in 1857. So that kind of distracted them for a little bit, but the attack began in 1856. And then Yi Mingcheng ordered all Chinese soldiers manning the force not to resist British forces. And after taking the fort, in the area, the British army attacked, Guangzhou directly. But it became an electoral issue. The Arrow incident was, it happened, but the press had exaggerated so wildly, they were simply making up stories. And it was for, you know, essentially for Palmerston's interest. Now, the Whigs were in control. I remember Palmerston was foreign secretary. The Whigs were in control, and they passed, or at least in control enough that they could pass a resolution. Not by much, though. It was like 263 to 249. The Whigs made the claim that we don't know enough about this. In other words, they didn't trust their own press. It states that, you know, without expressing an opinion as to the extent to which the government of China may have afforded this country cause of complaint respecting the non-fulfillment of the Treaty of 1842, this House considers that the papers which have been laid in the table failed to establish satisfactory grounds for the violent measures resorted to at Canton and the later affair of the Arrow, and that the Select Committee be appointed to inquire into the state of our commercial relations with China. And that was passed. So they don't trust their own press. They know that these extremely wealthy merchants control a lot of things in England. And so the press went crazy. And Lord Palmerston attacked the patriotism of the Whigs. How dare you? You're not patriotic supporting this. So the Parliament is dissolved, and there was a very famous election in March 1857. And the Chinese issue was important. Now there was something else. And this is more of almost comic relief here than anything else. Something called the Essing Bakery Incident of 1857. In Hong Kong, there was a Chinese-owned bakery, the Essing Bakery, that allegedly tried to poison pretty much all the bread in the city, including, you know, some very important people. This is a very large institution. That they laced their bread with arsenic as a terrorist incident to drive the British out of Hong Kong. Well, they did a very bad job of it because they put too much in. If you put too much arsenic in something, you throw it up because your body can't handle it, and it doesn't do anything. You may get sick for a while, but that's it. It was a non-lethal dose in that sense. Now, the owner, allegedly, was Chiang Ah Lum, not a Chinese name. He was acquitted by a jury, by the way, and the prosecutor, though, made it clear that he should hang anyway, just for the sake of satisfying British pride. This is a false flag. There was arsenic somewhere, but it was a way to ensure Palmerston's dominance and to make sure that the next war was going to happen. The huge amounts that were put in this, they were done deliberately. It was overdoses so that they wouldn't kill anybody. They wanted a terror incident. They wanted people sick, but no real casualties. Now, the King State couldn't have been involved, given what had happened. And there was a mess. We'll get to the Taiping Rebellion in a minute. They were in no position for war. There was no way they could have been involved in this. The name Cheung Alum, first of all, isn't Chinese. And the Church of England actually noted that bakers often added potassium alum, or just alum, as a whitener. So it was a play on words. Cheung Alum, spelled Cheong Ahlum. There is no such name in Chinese. But it didn't matter, though, because the London Morning, but this is what the London Morning Post said about the so-called poisoning. It's an act of hideous villainy and unparalleled treachery of these monsters of China, defeated by its very excess of iniquity. Perpetrators are noxious animals, wild beasts in human shape without one single redeeming value, demons in human shape. This is the rhetoric in a major newspaper. Here they had 10, there were 10 defendants here. Here are some of their names. We have Cheung Alum, Cheung Achu, Cheung Ahip, Cheung Achok, Lumasau, Tamalin, Fong Angi. These are ridiculous names. None of them are Chinese. They're invented plays on words and goofy, you know, just, and even the Globe, which is another newspaper at the time, published a fabricated letter by this Cheung Alum, saying that he had agreed to poison on the order of the viceroy, Yu Mingchen. But the press sat on, the guy was acquitted, but they sat on that news until the election occurred. So by the time the news of his acquittal was published on the 11th of April, the election had already happened, and Palmerston not only was victorious, but he had a big majority. This is how, so you have, two false flags. You have the era, which was, largely an invention. And then you have this bakery poisoning, wild beasts in human shape with all these made up names. Talk about Johnson's Law. No one could even look at these names without laughing. But public ignorance was so great, it didn't matter. They were foreign. They kind of sort of sounded Chinese. So I guess it must be true. But there was something else going on, something else that I've been fascinated by for a long time, something called the Taiping Rebellion. It's the single most bloody civil war in world history, and it's tightly connected with the Second Opium War and the reason why the French were involved in it. Hong Zhuquan was born in 1840, claimed to be the brother of Jesus. He was a smart kid who failed his state examinations to work for the government 4 times. He had a nervous breakdown. And having lost his mind, he came under the control of a Baptist preacher in China, Issachar Jacques Roberts, and then before him, Edwin Stevens. And in his delusion, he created a cult called the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom that had the destruction of the state, as well as opium use, by the way, as its primary goal. The Manchu dynasty were demons in human form. The Taiping also often referred to the Manchus as demons, and that they were fighting this holy war to rid the world of demons and establish a paradise on earth. But at its height, his kingdom contained 30 million people. The death toll was 40 million. Now, the Taiping Rebellion, in my opinion, was financed by the West to some extent. This is because they had tons of modern weapons that were not available even to the Chinese regulars. The force had grown that large and was very competently led and was defeating the government all over the place. The same arms dealers that sell to the government were selling to these guys in huge amounts. There is no way the British could not have known. Rifles and gunpowder were smuggled in, and they on the customs form it said it's snuff and umbrellas. And they were getting better equipment than the Chinese army was getting. In 1850, the rebellion begins in Guangxi. And in January of 1851, Hang Zhuquan declares himself Heavenly King of the new dynasty, the Heavenly Kingdom of Great Peace. And of course, Jesus' brother. The rebel army, about 10,000, defeated a king force. And a guy named Feng Yushan was their chief general. And the more he defeated the government in open combat, these huge armies, the more people were flocking to him. Not to mention the fact that in some of the rural areas, you had bandit gangs, I'm convinced, supported by the British, with weapons and everything else that were joining him. And his army grew to massive numbers. His army very quickly reached the 500,000 mark. And again, it suggests Western assistance. So 1853, the Taiping forces captured Nanking, making it their capital. And what they did is start a massive slaughter of the Manchus that were living there, which is a lot of people. They began slaughtering them, and they said, we're going to slaughter the entire Manchu population because they are demons in human form. Of course, you know, this is a Qing dynasty also at war with Great Britain. And, you know, the soldiers under him were instructed to slaughter all Manchus. So when Nanking was occupied, this is an actual rape of Nanking, Taiping movement, burning and hacked about 40,000 Manchus to death in the city. They first killed the men, and then they forced the Manchu women outside of the city and burnt them to death. And of course, the terrified Manchu king state responded in kind. The Heavenly Kingdom, as he called it, controlled all of southern China. And it controlled the Yangtze River Valley, which meant that he was able to grow all the food. He was self-sufficient. He got everything he needed. It was a communist movement. He was abolishing all classes. Of course, because he failed his examinations, he remade the examinations, but using the Bible in quotes, rather than Confucius. Because the Bible, you know, it was a loose translation. It was mixed with all kinds of superstition and all kinds of folk religion, some Buddhism. It was all mixed together in his mind. Private property was abolished. All land was owned by the state, which meant it was owned by him. And the sexes were declared equal. With all these groups, you know, the millennial groups in Northern Europe, Reformation, Fifth Monarchy, and all this stuff, they all said that. It was really weird that sexes are equal, which meant that marriage was abolished, which meant that the wealthy could have all the women they wanted. And so suddenly, you know, but this is reported in the Western press as, or in the Western history books as gender equality. And it got so bad that they had to separate the sexes anyway. And they had separate army units for women. So they banned gambling, tobacco, alcohol, polygamy, slavery, and prostitution. And of course, the worst sin of all was opium. Now, the reason I mention this, massive rebellion. The French get involved and created the Second Opium War because, a French Catholic priest, Chapdelaine, Auguste Chapdelaine, was executed. And this was the proximate cause of the French declaring war on the King State. Now, he was accused and convicted of preaching Catholicism in the interior of the country, which according to the treaty was illegal. He was in rebel territory, and many of his converts were already marked as traitors. So when he was executed, that was the French excuse to join the British. And of course, the real reason was to move in on some of these profits. But the British didn't mind the assistance militarily. Notice this is very similar to the coalition against Russia in the Crimean War. So, needless to say, Chinese forces were defeated with ease. You know, the imperial government of China had no real regular navy. And this is where, you know, this is why they were slaughtered. And there were a number of treaties that were forced on the Chinese, always being changed, always being for, you know, essentially it says now we can sell opium throughout the entire country. We're allowed to go on the Yangtze River. And of course, you have to pay an indemnity of 4 million taels of silver to Britain and 2 million to France. As always, they demand the cost of the war be paid. This is a government, by the way, dealing with the Taiping Rebellion, which slaughtered 40 million people at a minimum. There was only one real battle, one of the Taku fortresses in June of 1859. The British Marines were stuck in mud. They misread the tides, and because they were stuck, the Chinese batteries killed a few hundred of them. And Palmerston lost his mind. He said, "We will teach such a lesson to these perfidious hordes that the name of Europe will hereafter be a passport of fear." And he ordered, when Beijing actually fell, they ordered the city to be ransacked. And this becomes the, and I want to mention this here, becomes the thesis of a great book. Mainstream Press. It's Eric Ringmar. It's 2013. Liberal Barbarism: The European Destruction of the Palace of the Emperor of China. Why? Why did he mention this? Why is this liberal barbarism? He argues this is a landmark event in the creation of globalism. The point was to deliberately destroy. I mean, they were burning ancient scrolls. This is, and they didn't do it just in Peking. They did it everywhere. And the explicit reason, I mean, the revenge for this, they dared win a battle. But because Britain had declared that they were going to remake the country. Because globalization, which is a natural outgrowth of liberalism, can't exist when you have closed traditional societies like China was. This is why in every city they occupied, they destroyed absolutely precious ancient artifacts going back millennia. Someone wrote that they, one guy was lighting his cigar with a 3,000-year-old scroll that he had on fire. And this is absolutely important. The Convention of Beijing was signed in 1860, which ended the Second Opium War. And again, the humiliation of having British and French, even actually Russian at the time, diplomatic presence in Beijing, which implies equality with the emperor, which was designed to be humiliating. And freedom of religion established in China, so that the, you know, Protestants could again remake, have them more closely connected to Britain, just like they're doing in Russia now. Protestant fundamentalism, you know, is an American Zionist front, at least as far as foreign affairs is concerned. And then one of the articles of the treaty is that British ships were now allowed to carry indentured Chinese to the Americas. The indemnity to Britain and France was now increased to 8 million taels of silver apiece. And of course, the legalization of the opium trade with no exceptions nationwide. So on the new peace treaty here, and of course, this was changed. 1864, there was another one. Now 20 million pounds as China sinks into addiction. And again, the British were propagandizing this so that the opium will solve your problems. It will cure your diseases. You talked about the amount that they were importing. 1880, now 20 years afterwards, the Sassoon family was importing 60,000 chests of opium, and within a few years, 105,000. As if the Sassoon family wasn't wealthy enough. And the Sassoons also control the licensing of opium dens in every British-occupied area. And by the way, only Jews were permitted to staff these companies, as the Jewish Encyclopedia itself says. And with all this, opium could not be imported into Britain. Now, the reason I talk about all of this and why it's absolutely so significant. And I believe in Eric Ringmar's analysis. And the reason I'm doing it now is that this is a seminal event in the development of globalist ideology. China was a huge, you know, China was then kind of what Russia is now to the West. This huge nut that they're trying to crack. Globalization can't occur if this massive market is closed off and run on traditional lines. It has to be destroyed. This is part of what opium was. It wasn't just making money. It became a weapon. That's why they became absolutely obsessed with it. You know, they would lie. They'd pretend it wasn't opium. They would talk about British goods in the abstract, whatever it is. The point is that this was a weapon to destroy the will to resist. The command of the looting of cities is extremely significant. And it was done, you know, this is essentially, this is what liberal imperialists do to non-liberal society. Every town that they took, if there was a point, anything, and what they were targeting, they saw the same thing in Iraq in the 90s. And it became this Dionysian frenzy. Hezhou, on September 16th, Allied forces broke into a large pawn shop and it had gold and silver and fur coats and stuff. And it was looted, you know, until nothing left. Soldiers got drunk on Samsu, one of the local drinks. These soldiers began dressing in women's clothing. They began killing domestic animals for no reason. They began breaking their legs and just so they couldn't eat. They couldn't get to their food. They'd watch them die. Why? This was just ludicrous. Alcohol can't explain that. This was direct cruelty for no obvious reason. It was a Dionysian frenzy. Men, women, pigs, dogs, cats, anything. And this was state policy, not to dress in women's clothes, but this Dionysian idea of breaking down the traditional Confucian society of China. Now, the fact that the Taiping movement had 30 million members suggests that the country was ripe for Christian conversion. Now, because of the Taiping movement, for decades afterwards, Christ was a word of fear because everyone associated it with this lunatic claiming to be Christ's brother. And the fact that 40 million, so you have a Qing dynasty that was struggling to begin with economically. It's been humiliated in two wars. It's what little navy it had destroyed, its infantry destroyed, with tens of millions of addicts, with a government that could dictate terms to it, an enemy, not just pushing or selling opium, but pushing opium and justifying it. You know, and forcing them to pay this, you know, Versailles level kind of indemnity. But understand what this means. You know, liberalism is, you know, it has to do with in international affairs, freedom of exchange, so-called British civilization, international law, unimpeded circulation of goods. And this was what the civilization was, and goods, you know, were very specific. And China didn't have this free circulation, therefore that was a problem. And they had walls around the kingdom, which is an awful thing. They were ignorant and weak because of it. The Opium Wars were a direct expression of liberalism. Globalist imperialism is liberal at its core. It doesn't make any sense otherwise. It was a revolution. In this case, it wasn't like Mao, who did it from the inside, even though he had Western funding. It was completely externally enforced. The Europeans made sure China would never, ever, ever be the same again. Everything. The scrolls were sought out and destroyed. Everything. The social fabric. All this, the authorities, all the ritual, all the tradition, structures of everything was gone. And the point was, of course, after the destruction of this, this is why liberals were able to take over 20 years later, and this is why Mao was able to take over after that. Because so much of the tradition was destroyed. China went from being one of the world's, if not the world's, dominant economic power, to what we now call today, in an anachronistic way, third world. That we're now, and all these ideologies, you know, Darwinism and Freud, everything else was pushed on them. You know, electricity, railroads, liberalism, all this was pushed on them. And of course, finally, it was brought down in 1911. But remember, this was not just an ideological matter. This was also driven by drugs. Drugs were the thin end of the wedge, so to speak. One reason I'm convinced that the Taiping Rebellion was at least partially a Western creation is, in fact, to prevent China from ever becoming Christian in any real sense. To become Protestant would be one thing, Calvin individualism, you know, however they interpret it. But to make sure that really there is no moral stricture there that can prevent them from buying British goods of all kinds, not just drugs, but any kind of anything that, you know, and using this group to destroy the social fabric. Then, of course, the military of the West destroying what was left. China went in a generation from a highly closed, traditional, hierarchical, rather prosperous society, a very large economy, to a poverty-stricken, third world backwater, which it has not recovered from. Only really now do you see any kind of real recovery under the Han so-called communist government. These wars were about drug profits. There's no question about it. Drug profits was the weapon, the cudgel to use against China and the traditional society at the time. That looting of these cities and these museums was state policy. But what had been the so-called Sinocentric international system in Asia disintegrated. And the rituals that, you know, connected to the emperors were gone. China attempted to join the new order on European terms and, of course, acted like a third world country. And they installed Prince Gong, who essentially was a British puppet, and he inserted China into the British-dominated British-dominated world. And they had the foreign office there established in China, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, 1961. Students had to learn foreign languages and had to learn and began dressing in Western ways and British ways. They had to, you know, essentially make themselves into European. European works, international law were translated to Chinese, but the dominant language in some of these elite groups was either English or French. So this was a liberal revolution. This was an extremely violent liberal revolution, and the two opium wars. But the Taiping Rebellion was directly connected to the loss of the first opium war, because the Qing dynasty had been humiliated so badly, and had completely failed to stem the. Although had the British not taken military action, they would have succeeded. But because of that, the government failed to control opium addiction. And therefore, this new revolution from within was absolutely necessary. What you're seeing here, of course, is the outlines of what we call today the New World Order. This is globalization. Globalization driven by drugs, the Jewish Sassoon family, and essentially an oligarchy using the state as its private enforcement arm. This is what we have today, and the Opium Wars were one of the first acts in bringing this about and creating the so-called postmodern age, where any traditional reaction against the Western liberal system is crushed with extreme violence. China then, possibly Russia now, either way, we have a very interesting future. Thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to
The Orthodox Nationalists.
with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.